To most, Bodie Miller is known as an Olympic and world champion alpine ski racer. Some would say even the best there's ever been. But in the world of horse racing, he's all that and a lot more. Miller is a passionate racing fan who has become deeply involved in the sport at all levels. This year, he hopes to add the crowning achievement to his horse racing resume, a win in the Kentucky Derby. Miller has bought into Derby contender Fast and Accurate, the winner of the Spiral Stakes. Bodie Miller is this week's guest on the Thoroughbred Daily News podcast. We'll be right back with Bodie Miller after this message from our sponsor, TaylorMade.
For over 40 years, buyers, sellers, and breeders alike have turned to TaylorMade for custom-fit solutions. From boarding to breeding to both public and private sales, our dedicated team stands ready to serve you. With expert advice from the Taylor brothers and their experienced team of account managers, you can count on TaylorMade to provide the personalized service you deserve and expect. Visit TaylorMadeFarm.com and discover what the worldwide leader in thoroughbred sales and marketing can do for you.
Bodie Miller is really flying.
More than 7/10 ahead. Working his way toward the finish line here. There's a tight flush coming to the line. Let's see how he handles it.
No problem down here. This looks good.
And he's into the lead by 3/10 over Kotelich. That's a look of pure joy on the face of Bodie Miller.
Tim, that was absolutely an outrageous run. You know, his best run of the season. He skied like a young Bodie Miller before the knee injury, before the ankle injury and everything else, but he used to point him down the fall line and just let him go. He was smooth, confident, no arms flailing, no close calls, just a dream run.
Been a lot of dream runs on the ski slopes for Bodie Miller. This is Bill Finley with this week's Thoroughbred Daily News podcast. And that was Miller on his way to another Olympic medal in 2010. And Bodie, everybody knows how you got involved in skiing. You grew up in ski country in New Hampshire, got a scholarship to a ski racing academy in Maine. And by 2002, you're already winning Olympic medals. But then how on earth did you get interested in horse racing?
It was about that same time, actually. We had Visa was one of the ski team sponsors, and they were also obviously involved in the Visa Triple Crown at that time. So Mike Lynch, who was an exec at Visa at the time, pulled me in and brought me to the Derby. And I'd been a fan, honestly, before that. My grandmother used to come out in the spring when we were doing tennis courts in New Hampshire with her pearls on and her fancy dress and a big hat and a drink in her hand and pull us in off doing, fixing up the clay tennis courts for our tennis camp. And she'd pull us in and we'd watch the Derby. I remember that as young as probably 5 or 6 years old. So it was in my family and it was definitely in my blood. And I think there was just, I really didn't recognize it until I dug into the sport a little bit more. It's always been a thrill to watch. And, I love objective sports. That's why I was so drawn to ski racing, is that no one could tell me that I lost or won. It was basically against the clock and against, the other competitors. And I thought that was really appealing to me. And I saw the same qualities in horse racing, such a raw sport and just kind of objective and whoever wins, wins. And of course the stewards jump in there every once in a while, but in general, it's there's a lot more similarities than you'd guess on the surface.
Now, in horse racing, you're very closely associated with Bob Baffert. You've developed such a strong friendship with him that he actually named his son after you. Quite an honor. How did you and Bob connect, and what role did he play in getting you even further involved in horse racing?
Well, it was a little bit backwards in terms of the perception. So Bob, and he watched me in the 2002 Olympics, the one you spoke of in Park City, Utah. And he just, we're very kindred spirits, and I didn't know him at the time, but he said, to his wife, he said, if I have another boy, I'm naming him Bodie. That guy is, he's a badass. He's out there charging. He gives everything he's got. And I think he just connected with my mentality and my approach. Then, little beknownst to him, he has a boy not long after that, names him Bodie. And it was the next year, I believe, that I was at the Derby, and one of the Sports Illustrated writers said, "Hey, let me introduce you to Bob. He named his son after you." And I knew Bob obviously from the 98, 90, that little stretch, 97, 98, 99, where he was incredibly successful, with Silver Charm. And, uh, And I went over in the paddock and met him, and he was, you know, just as normal as he is. He's just such a great guy. We hit it off right away, and I said, you know, I'm super interested in the sport and would love to pick your brain about it a little bit. And he was one of the first mentors in the sport that really kind of was an open book and just shared what he knew. And it was one of those really crazy relationships, because as much as I respect Bob, and his accomplishments are just mind-boggling to me in the sport, but it was, I said, Bob, you realize that you're doing, you know, a lot less than you could be in terms of really maximizing your athlete's potential. If you were a coach, you know, we'd be having a different conversation right now, as I did with coaches all throughout my athletic career, where I just realized really young that, you know, even though coaches played a huge role in an athlete's success, they were never perfect, and they always had gaps in their knowledge, and they always had gaps in the program. And I was sort of instrumental on the C team of integrating sports science and just different training methodologies. And I realized that right away, that while Bob is an unbelievable horseman and he's got such a gift for sort of just his eye for horse flesh is second to none, really. But he doesn't really know that much about physiology or sports science or, you know, training programs in a lot of ways. So it was cool because we worked together, we owned horses together, and he was just he's just been an amazing mentor and friend to me throughout the whole thing. And then it got to a point where I said, you know, Bob, I want to try some of these things out. And he obviously tried to steer me away from it. He said, you know, it's a really tough sport. And I said, hey, you don't have to tell me. I know it. And I came through a tough sport, too. So, you know, I'm doing it for all the right reasons. I just love the horses. And I love the, you know, the thrill of the whole thing. And it was kind of, so we're very close and we talk all the time. But, you know, I've sort of gone my own way. And if I ever have horses on the West Coast, I prefer that he trains them, just because he's such a fantastic guy and he has such an unbelievable success rate. But my East Coast program is more where my focus is at right now.
Well, hold some of those thoughts, because it's very interesting that you do have some very sort of, I would actually use the word revolutionary, ideas about how to train racehorses. And I want to get back into that, because that's a very interesting part of the conversation. Now, you're going to turn 40 years old this year, and you've been skiing less frequently in recent years. So what are your plans so far as your future in that sport?
You know, it's still somewhat up in the air. I've more or less retired. I mean, I still have an active membership, essentially, so my quota spot on the World Cup is still active, but that's partially to protect the spot for some younger guys on my team who can use that when I'm not racing. But, you know, at 40 years old, it's one of those things where, just like an aging racehorse, it's a very unforgiving sport. And if you keep pushing your luck and keep pushing your luck, eventually you can have one of those injuries that no one ever likes to see. And, you know, I was very fortunate to come through such a remarkably long career with so many crashes and so much high risk skiing and come out of it healthy, that I really felt like it was a prudent decision to kind of back off and reset and at least check where my priorities were and what my goals were. And I think in the last 2 years, with my you know, family and all these things kind of, you know, obviously filling up a much higher priority than skiing ever filled for me, it was just, you know, it's kind of impossible to go back and put them on the back burner, which is what it takes to compete at the highest level. You know, you really can't, be, you know, anything but fully committed to it.
Now, with skiing sort of in the rear view mirror, how much are you going to immerse yourself into horse racing? You know, it's been written and you have said that this is really your future. So, you know, are you ready to pretty close to turning that page where, I don't know if it's going to take up 100% of your time, but maybe it's going to take up 90% of your time or 80% of your time. How close are you to becoming a full-time horse racing person?
Well, that's the question. I mean, and obviously horse racing, just like ski racing, is a full time commitment. There's just no way to go halfway and do a good job with it. And that's why trainers are up at 4 a.m. every morning and, you know, go to bed tired every night. But, you know, in this case, still the same challenge arises. My family is my top priority. And I really feel like it's important to be there for my kids every day. And it's been a huge joy of my life to be able to pull that off. So I think that, you know, in the reality, I can't be committed to horse racing right now to the level that I hope to be in the future. It's a long-term project for me. Horse racing is not something you just jump into, you know, at the high level and hit home runs. It's just, you know, obviously if you're pure luck, you might be able to pull that off, but it's something I intend to do for the rest of my life. So I'm trying to feel out these, you know, these different sort of details and all the little parts of the sport that I need to get my head wrapped around. And then, you know, hopefully as my kids mature and I become more of an empty nester, that's when I intend to really, really be able to commit 100% of my time to it, as much as my wife will let me anyway.
Okay. Now, you're already an owner. You're getting into the breeding business now, and we'll discuss that in a little bit in later on in the podcast. Are we going to see the day, be it 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, or whatever, where Bodie Miller has a trainer's license and is running horses and maybe not just owning a Kentucky Derby contender, but training one as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's always been in the plans. It's just, as anyone will tell you, it's a, you know, it's a lifelong learning process. The guys who are true horsemen were literally born into it, and they usually have spent their entire life around the animals. I was lucky enough to be born, you know, on a farm in New Hampshire, and we had animals, we had horses. So I worked with draft horses pulling logs when I was really young. And so the animals, you know, the psyche of them is not that different, even though the physical appearance is quite a bit different. But I'm still miles behind, you know, even the more novice horse people out there. So, you know, I have a lot to learn, and I have a lot of growing to do there. So I'm not in any huge rush, although absolutely the goal is to be training under my own name at some point, and hopefully I make some friends and good contacts along the way that can continue to help me out, because I think one of the keys is to have a pretty broad-reaching program and, you know, be able to sort of hit the spots where you need to be.
Sure. Now, you've already taken at least one major step as you bought a barn at Fairhill in 2015, and it looks like you're putting the cart before the before the horse, so to speak, a little bit, since, you know, you're not actively involved as a trainer. So tell us the mentality behind that, the thinking behind that, you know, why you wanted your own barn, and are you leasing it to other people? What involvement do you have in it with the horses that are there?
Well, the idea there was that, you know, from my experience and my background, there's just no way to, I mean, okay, there's not no way, everybody's doing it really, but there's no way to effectively maximize the potential of an athlete, of a horse at the racetrack. I just don't, you're so limited in what you can do. And even just the psychology of the situation for the horse is really difficult. I think, you know, every trainer has dealt with horses that turn a little sour on them, or that, you know, that just sour of being at the track and seeing dirt and doing the same routine all the time. They're an animal that's designed to be in a different environment. So my plan was to make sure that I had the facility to make sure that I could hit the spots. Once I had that facility in place, I was confident that I could really start to move the needle a little bit. And again, we're talking about small percentages here. We're talking about, you know, the difference between a claiming horse that can run a mile and a 16th in 1:46 and a stakes horse, you know, a very high level stakes horse in some cases are 1:41 or 1:42 for a mile and a 16th. And that, you know, that's a small percentage. That's 4 or 5%. So if you start chipping away at how you pick up those percentages, you'll end up, you know, with success in the long run, but it is a long process. It's a, you know, it's a process of slowly chipping away at how you're going to nip those 1 or 2% at a time. And as an athlete training, you know, we have huge improvements sometimes in the human world. And mm-hmm. I believe there's somewhere in that same neighborhood in the equine world. It's just, you know, there's a lot of things we don't really.
I assume that's your son in the background. Are we going to see him in the 2040 Olympics?
And I hope to have him in the horses too. He loves going to the races, and he's going to be too big to be a jockey. So I'm guessing he'll be on the training side of it as a trainer owner. But I really think that there's such a magnificent attribute of the sport is that family oriented side
sure.
of it, where, you
sure.
know, having kids grow up around such magnificent animals. And, you know, the sad side is obviously the injuries and things like that. And that, you know, that's something that I think also teaches really valuable lessons, and that I hope to have an impact on as well. I want to move the needle in terms of improving the athletes beyond what the normal training programs do. And I also want to get the athletes prepared to tackle the competitions that they're put in more efficiently and more effectively so that they don't get hurt as much.
Absolutely. Well, skiing and horse racing are two very different sports, but they do share one thing in common. The faster you go, the more chance you have of winning. Has Bodie Miller learned anything from skiing that he can apply to horse racing? That'll be our topic when we return after this message from our good friends at TaylorMade.
Attention sellers, now's the time to start preparing for the upcoming yearling sales, and putting your yearlings on the path to success begins right now. As the worldwide leader in thoroughbred sales and marketing, the expert team at TaylorMade knows what it takes to succeed at public auction. So if you're ready to get top dollar for your yearlings in 2017, visit TaylorMadeFarm.com and discover what we can do for you.
But he already talked about this, and it's a fascinating subject to me. The way people train horses today is more or less no different than the way they trained them 100 years ago in 1917. And the sport might be able to use a little outside-the-box thinking. And is there anything in particular from your training as Olympic skier that might help you become a better horse trainer or think differently than the average horse trainer?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's really was one of the driving forces that pulled me into this side of the sport, is that if you want to do comparisons, you'd actually have to be even more detailed and a little bit more accurate, in that we train quite a bit differently now than we used to. But the reality is that training, it's much less frequent, and the races are much less frequent, and the distances and level of training is much less. So really, we've just moved in one direction for quite some time now. And I think, you know, that happened in sports too. It happened in athletics, where, you know, what they kind of moved from having athletes who train, who, you know, the original professional versus amateur conversation was interesting. You were considered a professional if you actually practiced, if you trained, and an amateur was somebody who just kind of went out and did it. They had a real job, and then they went out and performed with no training whatsoever. And I would say horse racing moved back to being an amateur sport, where they more or less want the horse to just be born, run around, and then go out and race without any real formal training. And I think we've seen in human athletics that's by no stretch of the imagination the best way to get the highest level of performance out of an athlete. So, you know, in the case of you know, my experience, I sort of, as I said, I applied some sports science and some nutrition and really the frequency and intensity of training, and sort of saw firsthand how impactful that can be on performance. And, you know, it's really a remarkable opportunity for me in horse racing, in that things have really not, as you said, they haven't progressed the way you'd expect them to in a sport that's so comparable one-to-one to, say, track and field or any of these other sports, where the records are just shattered on a yearly basis.
Bodie, most racehorses literally spend 23 and a half hours or so in their stall doing absolutely nothing, half an hour of training a day. And, you know, from a layman's standpoint, you know, that doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. I imagine if you trained half an hour a day for your ski career, you never would have been anywhere close to being a success. Is that perhaps one of the things that you've thought of? Do we do too little in the way of training the racehorse?
That's exactly what I believe. And again, you know, I take it with a grain of salt, and everyone else should too. It's these ideas that I have are not revolutionary. People have tried them at various times throughout the evolution of the sport. But the problem was they didn't have a clear understanding. The knowledge base wasn't broad enough. You know, in my case, I have firsthand experience, so I kind of understand it from a different side. And I've had exposure to some of the top sports science and physiologists in the world. But the reality is we absolutely do way, way too little with these animals. If you compare it to, say, hunter jumpers or ranch horses, or, and everyone else would say, oh, thoroughbreds are too fragile. But the reality is they take off the track thoroughbreds and turn them into these horses that are just bomb proof, that just can run all day, can jump fences all, you know, out on a 4 mile race. And they just don't get hurt very often. It's just the way we do it in the thoroughbred world. It's exactly as you said. It would be like me taking an athlete like Michael Johnson or Carl Lewis, putting them in bed, telling them they had to lay still in bed 23 and a half hours a day, and then getting them up and having them sprint, or, you know, at 80%, 100 yards, you know, once every 7 to 10 days, And then every month saying, okay, we have a track meet. I'm going to have you run 400 yards today at maximum speed, or 800 yards. And you watch what would happen to those athletes. They might have a couple of good performances in them, but they'd rupture their Achilles tendon. They would blow out a hamstring or a calf muscle. They would just have chronic injuries all the time. And that's really, it's exactly what we face in the throwback world. So from a physiological standpoint, it's really kind of a no-brainer. But the question is, how do you get more training in an environment like at the racetrack, which is where most thoroughbreds spend their time? At a racetrack, you got limited time on the track, you know, morning training sessions only, and they don't want you doing a whole lot. It's kind of a restrictive sport in that way. So that's where the barn and the farm at Fair Hill came into such a critical role, was that it allowed me to sort of dictate my own program a little bit and try to put quite a bit more volume in. And then at the same time, you need either the knowledge or the technical advancements that allow you to monitor what you're doing. Because if you're just going by eyeball, I mean, when Tom Ivers did his thing in the 80s and, you know, into the 90s, the ideas are really sound. They're great ideas. But without monitoring systems and without the full knowledge base of what you're doing, you end up hurting a lot of horses that way as well. And it's just, you know, it's a fine line that you have to walk as an athlete. And as I said, I was very, you know, sort of novice at this when I was a young athlete. And I learned through a very long career how fragile that line is, but also how beneficial it is if you can manage it. So, you know, I think it's really, that's what's such an exciting concept for me, is that I know it firsthand and I've seen it. I mean, mm-hmm. I watched athletes turn themselves into just absolute beasts through really well done training programs. And right now what I see out there is a lot of really talented raw athletes, the horses, getting the job done, but certainly not doing themselves any favors with their training program. And unfortunately, you know, astronomically high injury rates.
Sure, sure. And Bodie, nobody walks into the barn and on day one becomes an expert as a trainer. Most start on the ground floor and work their way up from there. But people like Todd Pletcher basically went to school, in his case, the Wayne Lucas University. I can't see starting off walking hots for Bob Baffert. Can you skip some of those steps and be successful?
Yeah, I don't know. That's the question. I mean, as you said, no one comes into this knowing, but also the same concept. No one's born, you know, knowing how to be a good ski racer or knowing how to run a hedge fund, or, you know, it's all learned stuff. So to some degree, it's a disadvantage not having been underneath some of these really experienced, knowledgeable trainers, because there's so much incredible knowledge that comes through the generations that gets passed down from one mentor to a pupil. But at the same time, there's a lot of insecurities and bad habits and misinterpretation of information and you know, things like that that also get passed along. And I think we're in an era right now where that has really taken its toll, where a lot of these top trainers right now came out from underneath other top trainers who had, you know, a series of bad experiences, and you're forced to draw conclusions on those experiences. You have to sort of assess what's going on, and you break a bunch of really good horses down, you know, and you start making changes to your program. And the reality is you might not have been making the correct assessments. And I think that was very common in the last 20 or 30 years. And I think it's pushed us in one direction. And then you also see, you know, the money and the prices of the horses skyrocketing, and the top people buying really good horses. And there's a lot of excuses that can kind of justify why people make the decisions they make. So, you know, I think there's a big advantage to some degree having not come out from underneath one of those experienced trainers, because I don't also carry the same baggage that they had accumulated over their career, which some of that, as I said, is really valuable, and some of it is throwaway.
Sure. Now, I know you're still a few years away from doing this, and you talked about family comes first and all that, but you obviously have thought this out quite a bit. You know, when you are fully immersed in this, what kind of stable are you looking at? Are you looking to be another Bob Baffert with 75 horses, or are you looking for somebody who's just going to have some fun, maybe have a good horse, maybe have a couple cheap horses? What do you foresee the Bodie Miller stable looking like?
Yeah, so I want to compete at the highest level. You know, I want to win the Triple Crown. I think I want to win the Breeders' Cup, and those are the goal. But what ends up happening is you accumulate horses over time, because I also don't believe in the philosophy of racing horses until they're 3 and a half, and then retiring them. I mean, there's obviously a precedent for that right now, and the financial incentives are certainly real. But I think it's bad for the sport. I really do. I think that I don't blame anyone for doing it, because it is what it is right now. But
if you have a way that you can really condition a horse to be sound, and you have a really solid, you know, physiological monitoring system where you can sort of predict and you can really tell when chronic injuries are creeping up, I think it's possible to very safely race a horse till they're 6, 7, 8, 9 right. years old with no increase in injury at all. I think the real chances of injury are when they're really young. They're just underdeveloped. They sure. don't, you know, there's a lot of issues that come along with that. So my thought is that, you know, I'll be shooting for superstars all the time and hope to train them through those 2 and 3 year old seasons, but then not getting rid of them or discarding them as they get older. I want to keep, cause I've also seen it a million times, where an athlete comes into it at 20 years old or 25 mm-hmm. years old. And I think it's the exact same in horses where, you know, you find the right combination of rider, training program and race series for a horse. And you can all of a sudden tap into a 4 or 5 year old horse and really figure some things out. Cause the reality is these horses are so closely bred. We're dealing with very small deviations from the performance criteria. I mean, they're, you know, a normal baby born, you know, there's maybe born into them, it's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of a 5% variation in what they're capable of doing. And some of that's raw speed. You can tell that by going to a 2-year-old sale. Mm-hmm. You look at a 2-year-old sale where there's 1,100 horses, they all breeze between 9 and 3 and, you know, 11 and 2. It's like, you know, that's a 10%, and that's half the horses that are going in 11 aren't even running. They can't figure out how to put one foot in front of the other one. But there's no question that they have the ability to go 10 and a half mm-hmm. seconds for a mm-hmm. furlong. And that, to me, that represents way more speed than you'd ever need to run. And unless they have a throat problem or some real, you know, physiological malfunction going on, all you need to do is condition them. I mean, you or I, we're not aerobic athletes, but we right. certainly could have a massive improvement in our anaerobic ability with the right training program. I think that's sort of what's missing.
Sure. Fellow Olympian Michael Phelps is another who is heavily involved in horse racing. Just curious, have you ever talked to him? Have you ever compared notes? Have you ever met him and discussed the game that both of you love?
Yeah, just briefly. My wife was good friends with him growing up, and I spoke to him a little bit about it, but he's more just, you know, he really enjoys the sport, but wasn't really that interested in getting into this side of it. He's more of an owner who was more buying into the program that exists. I was more of an owner who bought into it to some degree, but felt a very strong desire to change it and to try to make an impact and move things, because I've just seen it for too long that when things stagnate the way they have, it's just not good for anybody. It's not good for the sport. It's not good for the owners or the horses or anybody.
These two square off as they turn for home. A Fleet Willie on the outside, Piece of Eight on the inside. Next in line, that's Ravenheart rallying in third. They've got a furlong to go. A Fleet Willie in front by 2, but Ravenheart's gobbled up the ground on the outside. Here comes Ravenheart with a strong rally, and Ravenheart to the outside, a Fleet Willie on the inside. Ravenheart begins to edge away. First time starter, Ravenheart wins it for Cal Sedina by a length and a half. A Fleet Willie second, Piece of Eight third, Loyalty Spirit fourth.
Now, buddy, I know you've owned horses with different owners and whatnot, but as I looked up your record, that appears to be the first horse that you won a race with strictly as the sole owner. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that must have been a pretty cool occasion. What was that feeling like to see Ravenheart win at Delaware Park in 2015?
It was amazing, as you can imagine. I mean, anybody who's experienced it, even from the outside, it's an incredible thrill. And I picked that horse at the sale, I watched him grow and I watched him mature. And he was a horse with very little raw speed. Again, a horse at a 2-year-old sale who would have been slow. I mean, no one would have been on anybody's radar. And that's how come I got him for such a price. But you know, he had unbelievable stamina. He was like a street sense type of horse. And it was unfortunate that I didn't have more of my infrastructure in place to really try to maximize that, because in a regular training program, he wasn't getting nearly the kind of work he needed to be able to naturally flatten out and run those kind of high 11, low 12 second furlongs and just keep going. But it was his natural gift. And it was really an exciting time to watch him. And even that first race, you got a sense of it. He kind of got out there and just, once he leveled out, he just came, you know, started gobbling up ground, nice long stride, and just cruised up by those horses. And, you know, he's pricking his ears as he goes across the line. You know, it gave all of us shivers. You know, my family was watching, and you know, it was really a huge thrill for everybody who supported me through this process. So it was such a such a fun experience to share with everybody. Nice to be on the sidelines when the cross is the line instead of being the one who's exhausted and bent over crossing the line.
I bet. Well, so far, Bodie Miller has pretty much just sort of dabbled in the sport, but he's ready for the big time. He'll have a horse in this year's Kentucky Derby. We'll take a look at Fast and Accurate after this message from our friends at TaylorMade.
TaylorMade, the worldwide leader in thoroughbred sales and marketing, is your number one source offering the full spectrum of bloodstock services. With over four decades of experience and the industry's top resources, TaylorMade has the power to help you achieve your loftiest goals. Last year, horses consigned by TaylorMade sold for nearly double the general market average. So if you're looking to get the most for your yearlings, make 2017 the year you give TaylorMade a try. Visit TaylorMadeFarm.com and discover what we can do for you.
Fast and Accurate takes the lead as they turn for home in the 46th renewal of the Spiral Stakes. And it's Fast and Accurate who has the lead by a length and a half. Through from between horses, Convict Pike is gaining. And down the center, here comes Kitchen's Cat. They have a 16th of a mile still to go. Fast and Accurate still up top. Convict Pike lunging to the inside. Kitchen's Cat to the outside. Blue Lidge Traveler along the rail. Fast and Accurate wins the Spiral Stakes by almost a length.
Fast and Accurate winning the Spiral Stakes, getting the points to get into the Kentucky Derby. And Bodie, after that race, you got involved, you stepped up. What did you see in that horse, and why did you want to be involved in the ownership group taking him to the Kentucky Derby?
Well, that's obviously an easy question to answer, but everyone could answer that one. It's always exciting to be an owner, a partner of a horse going to the Derby, but I also am a part owner of Enhance, who ran the front of that race for the first half, and I'd been a part of his campaign over the last several months, and was really excited to see them go against each other because Fast and Accurate, I think, he's got a real nice balance of things. I mean, you see him there; he gets tired at the end of that race, but he also was being pulled along by a pretty fast pace by Enhance, and that was more or less on purpose. And I said, look, let's run him out there and send him. Enhance has a little bit of a, you know, I would call it a breathing problem, but he's a magnificent horse, tons of raw speed and a great attitude. But I kind of suspected that would be a problem. And I wanted to see if Fast and Accurate, you know, I had the offer from Dr. Hansen, who's a friend of mine, a great guy and a fantastic owner to be involved with, just because he's so enthusiastic and excited about the sport and just very passionate about it. He had the offer out there if I'd wanted to participate. And I said, let's run this race and I'll take a hit on how much I can contribute. Because obviously I'm taking less risk if I wait till after the race,
right.
But I said, do me a favor and send Enhance out there fast and put Fast and Accurate as close to him as you can and try to hang on and see what happens once Enhance started. I knew he was going to kind of hit the wall. But he's got such a great fighting attitude that I knew he would kind of inspire his brother. And it was cool to watch because it really was. That was a good pace, and he held on. And you see horses, you know, catching him a little bit. But I think he learned a lot and is going to move forward from that. So I'm excited to see it. I haven't seen a Derby field that I really was in such a limbo about of how the race was going to be run. But, you know, this race, I think, sets up very well for him. I'm excited.
Now, as you well know, he's not going to be one of the favorites, and the critics will say, well, he's just a synthetic track specialist. How confident are you? Are you going to the Derby to sip mint juleps and have a good time, or are you going there to win the race?
It's always a combination. I go to support the Barnstable Brown fundraiser every year. They take me there. So, while I will be supporting my horse and Dr. Hansen, I go there more for fundraising. My father has diabetes, and they do some remarkable things for the diabetes foundations. And so I've been there for the last, whatever it is, almost, you know, 18 years, supporting them after the Visa Triple Crown invitation more or less expired. But I mean, I think, as I said, I'm not sure about this season. It's a really hard one to predict. As you said, he won't be a favorite, but I wouldn't predict that there's really going to be a standout favorite or at least more than one who people sort of start to lean towards as it gets closer. But what I like about this horse is that he's got that kind of grindy attitude. He's got raw speed to stay in the front if that's the way it goes. And if he settles in mid-pack, I think he will have plenty of kick left. He's one of those, you know, he's a hard trier. That goes a long way in my mind because, you know, there are front runners who, as soon as they get you know, behind, they just quit, and he's not one of those. So he's shown a remarkable adaptability in his running style. And I like the way he covers ground. I think, you know, I think there's a good chance that he runs a race similar to what he just did in the Spiral, where he's on the front end with some speed. And then more or less when horses try to catch him, I think everyone's going to be pretty tired and there's not going to be any blistering closers that have enough time to get him. So I'm hoping we go for a win.
Bob Baffert and Dr. Hansen have two things in common. They're kind of big personalities. They're fun people. They're very enthusiastic. And it's interesting that these are the two people you've aligned yourself. Are these just kind of the type of people you gravitate towards?
Or gravitate towards me. I'm not sure which it is, but I'm thankful that both of them have. I mean, they're both, like you said, they're unique personalities. I call them lunatics, but I'm certainly not off that list as well. I'm probably above them on the same list. So, but you know, they're people who follow their own way, who aren't, you know, they're not conformists. They go with what they think and what they believe, and I think that's important. I've always done that, and it's part of my nature, and you know, I think it makes things exciting, if nothing else. You know, you live by the sword and die by it. Of course, there's been lots of times where I've been humbled, and I know Bob has as well, and I know Dr. Hansen has as well. But it's, you know, it's remarkable what you can do when you kind of more follow your heart and kind of are willing to take some risk and willing to really dream big. I think that's an underrated quality. I think a lot of people kind of think, oh, you bought a horse for $5,000 or $20,000 or whatever. There's no chance that can be a Derby horse. But we've seen just in the last 10 years that that's just not the case. There's diamonds in the rough all over the place. You just got to kind of have that attitude, and you got to be willing to take the emotional leap to get your hopes up, because that's really what it's all about.
Now, at Keeneland January, you bought a horse by the name of Red Vine as a stallion prospect. You also have another stallion by the name of Unfettered. So kind of we've talked a lot about, you know, your training thoughts, your ownership thoughts, getting involved in Kentucky Derby. But tell us about your plans with these stallions and, you know, that aspect of the sport, where you're going when it comes to being a breeder and somebody that has a couple stallions.
Yeah, I think my concept was really to have a complete program, something vertically integrated. And that just comes from my knowledge of other industries and other sports. It's like, you know, like anything, if you have that, you kind of, you come in with an advantage. Any breeding I do, I'm theoretically going to be breeding to sell. That's just the nature of the industry. But you always have that option, and you always have, you know, as long as you can maintain some objectivity, which is tough when they're your babies and you dream big, as I said, but Unfettered, and both those horses were remarkable competitors. Unfettered is a horse that, had he been bought by Bob and gone to Southern California, I think would have had a completely different career, and we'd be having a completely different conversation right now, likely, because I would have had no way of affording the horse when he was ready to go to stud, but instead of getting him out of a claiming race. But if you look at what that horse could do, he won his maiden race. You know, sure, it was on a fairly fast track in New Mexico, but he won it in 108 going away, just easily galloping away from the field. And he's such a remarkable athlete. With everything he did throughout his career, you know, he had 9 wins and they're all small races, but you can't downplay his athletic achievements just because of the class of the race. There's too much there. If you, you know, from a horseman's eye, if you watch those races closely, he would have been doing that same thing at Santa Anita or anywhere else. He was just a remarkable horse. And I felt like I had felt somewhat obligated, and I felt for him because he'd been injured and had been in the claiming ranks. He had an unbelievable quarter crack that I saw firsthand, and they were just passionate and racing him anyway. And I just feel like for the price, I said, I got to rescue this horse. And if I can get him sound and race him, great. If not, I want to breed him. And he's a Rockport Harbor. He's got, you know, Phone Trick in there. He's just got a really cool, diverse, funny pedigree that's not going to knock anyone's socks off right now. But I'm hoping that as we get some good mares to him, I think he's got the potential to really throw some exciting young horses. In the 2-year-old and 3-year-old seasons, I think they'll have unbelievable speed, which is obviously catches anybody's eye. It doesn't matter what the pedigree is. If everyone's out there winning, it kind of shuts everybody up. And Red Vine is on the other end of the spectrum, you know, a Candy Ride, a miler, who just, you know, I don't know how many of his races you watched live, but he reminded me of a male version of Zenyatta. When he was coming in a race, you just knew it. You saw him spool up around the turn, and you were like, uh-oh, here he comes. And he'd just start picking off horses like they were standing still. And, you know, he beat every one of sort of my favorite top horses in the country at one time or another. He just didn't, you know, it was like one race or another stacked up just wrong for him to really have those huge victories that would have put him out of my price range. And again, you know, to get him for $25,000 is just, to me, it's indicative of the lack of thoroughness of this sport. You know, he's a remarkable horse, and I didn't want to race him just because I felt like he was getting to that point where I was, and it could have been a kindred spirit there, you know, and an older horse who ran his races and tried hard and always gave it everything he had. And it survived with no catastrophic injuries. Mm-hmm. And I think I could relate to that. So I'm really happy to be supporting those regional programs. I think there's some really cool incentives there. And, you know, I love the idea of being able to help people throw some really cool horses for those smaller programs that are really exceptional, that can go on to big things. Cause right now, you know how biased it is. It's like, you know, Kentucky and basically Kentucky.
Exactly. All right, so now I'm going to go off on a wild tangent, but I have to ask this question anyways. Anyone who listens to our radio show on Sirius XM Radio knows that I'm a Red Sox lunatic. You grew up in New Hampshire. Do we share that passion by any chance?
We do. I can't call myself a lunatic about the Red Sox any more than I am about anything else, but I was an avid fan and huge Johnny Damon fan back in the day, and you know, Big Poppy and Martinez. We had such a great run to see that, to be, you know, to be alive during that era,
right,
after what they went through for the last, you know, 100 years, was really exciting. My little sister is an avid fan, so I got to take her to a bunch of games. I threw out the first pitch a few times, so I really felt pretty privileged to be able to witness that and to be involved to some degree. And I'm friends with a few of those guys, so it was you know, that really solidified my roots there of being a New England sports fan. Even though now I'm transplanted out to the West Coast, I definitely am still a Patriots, Red Sox, mm-hmm, Celtics, you know, the usual.
Well, very cool. And as we speak, they are losing 1-0 to the Yankees, so that's not putting a smile on my face. Buddy, the last question and the corniest question, but it has to be asked. It's all hypothetical, but what would be the bigger thrill, winning an Olympic gold medal or winning the Kentucky Derby?
For me, it would absolutely be winning the Kentucky Derby.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, of course. You know, ski racing was always something that I pursued because I loved competing. I just loved the thrill of the sport. And whether I won or not, I tried to convey that to people. It was amazing to be out there running. I imagine, you know, there's somewhat similar of a thrill to being a jockey. But it's different when you're the competitor. Because, I mean, I had races when I was 8 years old that were as big a thrill as the Olympics were. But then as I got older, your expectations grow, your knowledge grows, everything grows, and the Olympics becomes where you belong and something really normal. So, you know, for me at the Derby right now or even in the future, that's going to be something so out of my normal range, mm-hmm, and something I'll have to work really hard to get to. You know, and really have that belief that I talked about. It'll be an absolute thrill. I can't say until I do it, but I'll call you afterwards and let you know.
Okay, terrific. Well, Boney Miller, thanks so much for your time. You've been an absolutely terrific guest. Congratulations on all your success on the ski slopes and the Olympics, etc. And here's hoping that you duplicate every bit of that success on the racetrack. Thanks so much for being part of the TDN podcast. Thanks to our sponsor, TaylorMade. And Bodie, good luck to Fast and Accurate in this year's Kentucky Derby.
Absolutely. Appreciate it. Thanks,
Bodie.